You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 3rd of April 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London, with me, Andrew Tuck, and Guy Delaunay.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes.
As Peru's president heads to China, we look at why Beijing is so welcome in Latin America for now.
People are quite worried in the United States about China's entry into Latin America. And when you actually look at the numbers in terms of the trade, in terms of loans that the Chinese give to Latin American countries, there's a lot less there than many people have promised or many people have feared.
And Tom Edwards, Monocle's news editor, will be here looking at what's crucial to know today in our new agenda setter.
Plus, we head to Colombia to take the temperature of the entrepreneurial spirit in Medellin.
The government's doing a great deal to support entrepreneurship. So right now, there's an organization in Medellin called Ruta Yane. I believe it's around a $60 million annual budget to support innovation and entrepreneurship.
All that, plus we assess whether China's art market is losing its vitality ahead of a major Sotheby's auction, get the news from Jakarta, and add some music with a tangential news hook or two. All to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
But first, let's catch up on the headlines with Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. The US Secretary of State John Kerry has promised that America will defend itself and its allies in the face of aggression as tensions rise on the Korean Peninsula. Mr. Kerry was speaking at a State Department event in Washington with the South Korean Foreign Minister Yoon Byung-se. On Tuesday, Pyongyang said it would revive a mothballed nuclear reactor capable of producing bomb-grade plutonium, but it stressed it was seeking a deterrent capacity and it did not repeat recent threats to attack South Korea and the United States. Mr. Kerry said the last few days had seen unacceptable levels of rhetoric from the North. And the Pentagon spokesman George Little has announced that two U.S. warships are now in the region.
On the Decatur and the McCain, they have arrived at predetermined positions in the Western Pacific, where they will be poised to respond to any missile threats to our allies or our territory.
In the latest development, North Korean authorities have barred South Korean workers from entering a joint industrial park on the northern side of the border. It wasn't immediately clear if the move was aimed at closing the Kaesong industrial zone, which generates $2 billion a year in trade for the North and $80 million in cash wages that go straight to its government. South Korea's unification ministry says workers from the South who were at the park have been allowed to leave. A report by two American think tanks says Iran will pursue its nuclear quest, even though it has cost it well over $100 billion in lost oil revenue and foreign investment alone. A report by the Washington-based Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and the Federation of American Scientists said Iran's atomic work could not simply be ended or bombed away, and that diplomacy was the only way to keep it peaceful. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says Iran must work with the international community to address Western concerns over its nuclear program.
They have an ability to rejoin the community of nations to get out from under this isolation if they will choose the simple ways of proving, as other nations prove, that they have peaceful nuclear energy. It's that simple.
Crunch talks in Brussels aimed at ending the ethnic partition of Serbia's former Kosovo province have broken up without result. The Brussels meeting was the eighth between the prime ministers of Serbia and Kosovo. The talks were aimed at normalising ties 5 years after Kosovo declared independence with the backing of the West. The European Union's foreign policy chief, Catherine Ashton, says it was the last time all sides would meet formally with EU mediation, but she says efforts to resolve the issue are continuing.
A number of proposals were put on the table, and the gap between them is very narrow but deep. They will now both go back and consult with their colleagues in their capitals and will let me know in the next few days their decision.
Six New York politicians, including a senior state senator, have been arrested over an alleged bribery scandal involving the city's mayoral race. The charges centre on State Senator Malcolm Smith, a Democrat from Queens, who was widely considered a long-shot candidate for City Hall. Prosecutors say he made payments to a city councilman to set up meetings with top New York Republicans to assist in getting him on the mayoral ballot. Five other politicians, three Republicans and two Democrats, were also arrested and charged with collectively accepting more than $100,000 in bribes. Jane Henson, the former wife of the Muppets creator Jim Henson, who was influential in the creation of the popular US TV puppet program, has died at her home in Connecticut following a long battle against cancer. She was 78. In a statement, the Jim Henson Company, which is owned by the couple's five children, said she'd been an integral creative and business partner in the Muppets. She first met Jim Henson in puppetry class at the University of Maryland in the mid-1950s. She legally separated from her husband in 1986. After his death in 1990, she founded the Jim Henson Legacy to promote his work. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney. It's just 6 minutes past eight here in Bindori House in London. I have to say, I'm mightily relieved there was no decision on the Serbia-Kosovo talks, Andrew.
I know. You were very good at kind of bussing in some very good guests for us the last couple of days. Because I think most people know, but actually, you're normally based in Serbia, so this is the territory that you know very well.
That's right. And there is the general rule of thumb is, whenever a correspondent is away from their patch, that's when something interesting happens.
Yeah, I felt very, very sorry for our correspondent in Caracas. She came to London and Hugo Chavez died. That was literally the day that she left. That's not good timing, is it?
Not good timing. Very inconsiderate of Mr. Chavez.
Now, we've got a good show lined up, but we should perhaps have a short break and then we'll be right back.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 모노클 24입니다.
Ut London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is
Londres. Orlando.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to the new improved Midori House. For all our listeners, I think you're beginning to know now, we've shuffled the schedule and we've moved the show from its usual afternoon London time slot to a new morning slot. And it has a star turn at the top every day. It has the agenda setter. And that kind of lays out the stories and the big themes for the day that will be dominating the news, not just on our schedules, but on other people's schedules as well. And we've called in Tom Edwards, who's our news editor, who's going to be setting the agenda today, Tom.
I'm going to try, Andrew.
Good.
Let's aim high. Let's see how we go.
Where shall we begin?
Well, I think we should start in North Korea. We've obviously been charting the ongoing tensions. We're discussing a lot about whether this is mere saber rattling, how far does it go. We've actually explored what actually happens if, you know, it does ease into an actual conflict situation. More news kind of overnight. North Korea has stopped South Korean workers from going to this joint industrial zone that they have, which has been a kind of a rare example of a cooperation. It's sort of mutually beneficial from an economic standpoint. So again, is this more nose tweaking or saber rattling? Call it. I don't know if you can tweak a nose and rattle your saber at the same time. Probably you can.
You can, but it's a bit of a manoeuvre.
It's a bit of a manoeuvre. And, you know, you have to speculate now, how many more of these gestures can there be before the South, you know, well, maybe before the South loses patience?
I mean, this was part of it, the Kaesong Industrial Park, which is between the North and the South. I mean, that was one of the symbols of the sunshine policy, which South Korea used to have towards North Korea, the idea that if you were nice to them, they'd stop doing things like threatening to or zap you with missiles. So the symbolism is heavy, really, I think, Tom, in this.
Well, definitely. And if you actually look at the numbers, you know, there are about 100 factories within this complex. Most of the workers, obviously, are North Korean. I think it's about more than 50,000. But a lot of the managers sort of arrive each day from South Korea. There's a few hundred of them. And there were a number of people when they actually made this decision to block it off. I think there were some 850 South Korean workers there. Now, they were allowed to leave and return, because obviously there have been some fears that in the event of a sudden escalation, the people who were actually working in this Kaesong Park would essentially become immediately, you know, political captives. So at least they've been allowed to leave. But you've got people like the Unification Ministry spokesman, Kim Hyung-suk from the South, saying how deeply they regret this and urging an immediate lifting of of this ban. So one will chart, I think.
One today. Thing that gives you some encouragement that maybe there won't be war is that, in fact, many of those South Koreans, I understand, decided to stay because they didn't want to lose their jobs. So there's a community of people who actually think, actually, nothing's going to come of this. We're going to remain there. We should move on, Tom.
I thought I'd just mention Israeli airstrikes on the Gaza Strip again yesterday. Fairly widely reported, but I think we'll probably pick up on this later in the day. The first time since the truce towards the end of last year. And obviously, these are claims from Hamas that aircrafts have bombed fields near the border. They claim no injuries. The Israelis, for their part, suggest that there was a Palestinian rocket attack, which, again, injured no one, but they needed to make a kind of a sort of gesture of reciprocity in terms of this violence. Again, Israel claims that it was targeting terror sites, so it's the usual game of claim and counterclaim. And it'll just be interesting to see. This is obviously very much like on the peninsula we were just describing a moment ago, an awkward peace, an uneasy truce, and it remains to be seen how much this will be viewed as an escalation or just, you know,
or
a continuation of the
same. Or indeed how much it's an indication that the people in that region are saying, we'll sort things out for ourselves. Thank you very much, Barack Obama.
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's interesting from a timing perspective that we had this much heralded visit that, let's be frank, didn't seem to result in very much progress. I would say maybe between Turkey and Israel, that was progress. And I think that was certainly linked to Obama's visit. But in terms of the main business, not a lot was achieved.
We did a story some time ago when Zed Nelson, the photographer, went to Israel, and he travelled all the way around the borders, just looking at what it's like to be in a country where you literally have an enemy on every side. And it was interesting because overnight there was also news that up in the Golan Heights, an Israeli tank fired across the border, actually into Syria for the first time. And there was an exchange of handgun fire as well. So you realise, you know, that it is extraordinary that Israel, you can go to the beach and have a very regular day in Israel, but you have these kind of skirmishes now going on again all the way around its borders.
It's extraordinary. There's almost a potential, you know, flashpoint around every corner. It must be, I think you start to understand better how the mindset of, you know, maybe being rather more defensive than perhaps some might suggest they should be can happen when you have those kind of problems around every corner.
Now, a story that I know that you think I'm going to have nothing to say on, but I am actually.
Can I just say, there is no story about which I think that. But this is particularly interesting. I think, I mean, particularly given the way that Guy spent his week last week, or part of his week last week, football and fascism. This is really dominating the UK papers, but this is a story that actually has some international overtones and is indeed, I think, featuring on some front pages around the world. Sunderland Football Club, a kind of a middle ranking, some of them might not thank me for saying it, football club in our top flight in this country, have appointed Paolo Di Canio, a controversial figure, Italian player, recently stopped playing. He's been managing at a lower level in this country. And he has in the past courted controversy for a number of reasons, most notably perhaps because of his much oft-stated enthusiasm for fascism generally and for Benito Mussolini in particular. He is a player and supporter of SS Lazio, which was, of course, Mussolini's team. Mm. And Di Canio did things like he made the famous straight-arm salute after a Rome derby and this kind of thing. People in Sunderland, you know, a Labour heartland, a real sort of union town, they're not, shall we say, best pleased about this appointment. And there's been a lot of real kind of interesting debate in the newspapers. Now, I sometimes wonder whether, you know, people need a bit of a lesson in what real football fascism looks like, because it's a pretty ugly picture, isn't it, Guy?
Which is what I saw in Zagreb about a week and a half ago when Croatia played Serbia for the first time since those two countries became independent states. And there were no Serbian fans allowed in the ground for safety reasons, quite reasonably, you might think. But what was happening was that there was this call and response chant in the stadium. One side was shouting out Zadom, and the other side was shouting out Spremni. Now, this means for country ready. And this is what the Ustasha fascists of Croatia would chant in the 1940s as they were marching off to butcher tens of thousands, in fact, hundreds of thousands altogether, of anyone they didn't like, which included Serbs, Roma, and Jews. So it's obviously very inflammatory. Now, you will get people emailing you when you write articles saying they were fascist chants, saying, oh, no, it's just about the love of our country. But let's not kid ourselves here.
But it's a very difficult area, isn't it, Andrew? I mean, there's a lot of debate in this country about how to kick racism out of football, and One imagines this is not going to help.
I admit, a football outsider, that's the strange thing. You see this huge debate going on about kind of fascism in the game and racism and what to do about it. And then actually there was a very strange vox pop outside the stadium where they were asking people what they thought. And that really boring line is, oh, I don't think you should bring politics into football. Because if they think they've got a winning manager, it seemed to be okay. But someone did point out that actually 350 people were killed in that town by Nazi bombing raids, and that actually many people died as they went off to go to the war. Tom, I'm afraid we're going to have to bring this to a stop for the moment. But that's Tom Edwards, and he's done a very fine job at setting the agenda for this day. And coming up, as the Peruvian president, Ollanta Humala, heads to China, we'll be looking at the workings of a flourishing strategic alliance.
Berlin has long been a magnet for artists. As the city continues to evolve, Monocle Films explores how galleries and artists are being influenced by Berlin's complex presence.
One of the reasons that I'm in Berlin, and which is intriguing for me, is that the history is here. It's not necessarily in these bricks and mortar. It's somehow in this atmosphere. One of the great things with Berlin is it takes time to do things. Berlin is slow enough for art to happen.
Art in Berlin, a film about ghosts of the past with a view to the future, on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House. Now, it's an increasingly globalised world, and relationships between nations on different sides of the planet can be crucial to one or both for their economic prosperity. That's the case with Peru and China. Peru depends on China's loans and investments, and China needs the South American country's resources.
Banging the drum of investment, trade, and yet more investment, Peruvian President Ollanta Humala begins a 7-day trip to China today. And with China their biggest trade partner, with exchanges reaching $12 billion this year, and China playing a key role in Peru's mining, oil, and gas sectors, it is indeed a drum worth banging. Steve Bodson, our correspondent in neighbouring Chile, and Shannon O'Neill, Latin American policy expert for the Council of Foreign Relations in Washington, D.C., and also author of Two Nations Indivisible, join me before we came on air to explore the significance of the meeting. Shannon, perhaps first of all you could just explain to us why there is such a close link between Peru and China.
Well, we've seen in the last several years a huge increase in the trade between the two countries. From Peru, we see lots of commodities headed to China to fuel its growth. And then back from China, actually, we started to see finished goods come back, cell phones and other types of objects that come back for the growing Peruvian consumer class.
Now, when we hear these stories, especially in the West, it always seems to be in the context of how come China is winning at this game yet again, and why is none of this trade heading north? You know, why are the Peruvians not wanting to do these kinds of deals with the US, for example, or Canada? What is it about the way that the Chinese are doing business in Latin America that's so appealing?
Well, it's interesting. People are quite worried in the United States, or some are quite excited about China's entry into Latin America. And when you actually look at the numbers in terms of the trade, in terms of the foreign direct investment, in terms of loans that the Chinese give to Latin American countries, there's a lot less there than many people have promised or many people have feared. But there are a couple countries where China really has increased its presence. And one of those countries is Peru.
Now, one of the other things that we've seen as they've expanded throughout Africa is that they have, in some instances, for example, in Zambia, they began to tread on people's toes a little bit, that local communities weren't that sure about the people arriving and what seemed to be, you know, setting up encampments, not employing that many local people, taking what they saw as their nation's resources. Do you think they've learnt those examples, and now as they kind of expand in Latin America, they'll try to do better? Because there's already been protests, haven't there, in Peru by many communities, again, not very happy about what's going on.
Well, this is a lesson that the United States learned over many decades, is how do you, one, promote your commercial interests, which individual companies try to do all around the world, but how do you also think in larger terms, sort of the externalities, the diplomatic side of things if things go poorly or if individual companies don't treat those on the ground as well. And it's one thing the United States has struggled with over years, and now China has entered that. We've seen, as you mentioned, problems in Africa and some problems in Latin America. I think the big difference in Latin America, which Peru is one of those examples, is when you have a democracy, voters matter. And so the challenge for local politicians is when things like this happen and don't go particularly well with new investment and particularly foreign investment, how you balance it within a democratic context.
Steve, crossing over to you, you're sitting in Santiago. Chile has an incredibly long coast. You're facing there across the Pacific. Is Chile concerned that actually Peru is beginning to kind of steal a bit of a march? It's perhaps a slightly shorter shipping route across to China. Do you think that the Chileans and the Peruvians and all those Latin American countries that have coastlines on the west are beginning to battle it out a little bit between each other?
Well, there's certainly a competition to be the gateway to China, China's gateway to Latin America, and especially to South America. But the reality is that South America is an incredibly disconnected continent. There's one good road going from Chile over to Argentina, reliable year-round road. There's a highway that goes across Peru that goes over to Brazil. But basically, countries export their own goods. They import goods for their own public. There's very little trade where, for example, a Chinese ship would come and distribute goods throughout South America from one single port. So even though there's certainly been a lot of talk about becoming gateway to South America or South America's gateway to the world, it's at this point, that's not going to happen until they build more roads and more rail links.
So for you, when you look at what's happening, do you feel that there's kind of, as it were, plenty of pie for everybody to share out? Because Chile is, again, another country that's very dependent on the resources boom and has been clever at managing that wealth in the past. Do you think that Chile's future is also linked to that of China?
Absolutely. I think economy ministers in all of the countries of South America wake up every morning and check the news about China. This is the biggest market for the copper that's coming out of Chile. It's the biggest market for a lot of the resources coming out of Peru these days. Also, the grains coming out of Brazil and Argentina. So yes, throughout the region, people are absolutely pendiente, as they say here. They're very concerned. They're very conscious of what's happening in China.
Shannon, you referenced there that obviously that they are selling things like mobile phones from China into Peru. They're also selling military equipment as well. Does this make part of these deals feel a little bit kind of queasier that perhaps, let's be honest, Peru has a very good and robust democracy at this time, but do you feel that there's a kind of other trade going on around these deals that's perhaps a little bit more squeamish?
Well, I think there's two challenges for the governments in Latin America. One is, right, we've seen more military trade going back and forth, in part because militaries for many years, for the last 20-plus years in general in Latin America, have been underfunded, in part a legacy of the tougher times in the 1960s and 70s when there was often military rule in some of these countries. But the other side of the trade that's worrisome for Latin American nations, they're benefiting from this huge commodity boom, but they're also getting hit by the manufactured goods, the cell phones, the clothes, the shoes, and all sorts of other things that are cheaply made in China and are coming in and flooding their markets. And it may be good for consumers, but as these countries try to think about creating their own manufacturing base, it can be a challenge to have quite cheap Chinese goods coming in.
And Shannon, we've seen in Brazil, for example, the likes of the rubber industry have been protected because they've said, actually, we don't want all your cheap Chinese flip-flops. We've got Havaianas, for example, at home. We're going to put up trade barriers. We're going to protect those kind of industries which employ a lot of low to medium salaried workers. Are the other countries beginning to wonder whether they should put in some kind of trade regulations with China as well?
Well, we've seen differences in the way various countries have reacted, actually, to this global challenge. Brazil has done exactly as you say, put in subsidies, put in tariffs, other sorts of barriers, quotas to goods coming from the outside. Countries like Peru or Chile or Colombia or others have actually, in many ways, gone the other direction, and they've signed agreements such as the Pacific Alliance. They're trying to join the United States in the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And the idea here is the way they would compete is actually opening to the world and becoming part of regional or even global supply chains rather than trying to shut themselves off or particular industries off. So it's different approaches to a similar challenge.
And Steve, what are you seeing in Chile? Is there any examples there of them beginning to use trade tariffs?
I'd say no. The current government is not big on implementing new tariffs. There's certainly demand from the public, though. That's something that you really see. And over the last couple of years, we've repeatedly seen calls from the unions and from citizens' movements to not only reduce foreign, what they call, exploitation and thievery of the natural resources, but yeah, absolutely, as Shannon said, to protect the local industries, things like shoemaking, where the Chilean shoe industry has diminished dramatically over the last couple of decades as imports have increased. There's certainly a lot of demand for that from the public, but no, the current government has shown no interest in it, and we'll see. There's an election later this year, and we'll see whether that becomes an issue. It's pretty doubtful. I'd say at the elite end of Chile, it's pretty much a consensus that global trade is the way to go and protectionism is a thing of the past.
And that was Steve Bodzin in Santiago. We also heard from Shannon O'Neill in Washington. And we're going to be keeping our eyes on China next to ask, is the art party winding down, Andrew?
Well, let's find out, because China likes to describe its increasingly global influence as a peaceful rise, and its art market certainly rose to prominence and prosperity without any blood being shed. 2 years ago, more money was spent on artworks in mainland China than anywhere else in the world. Buyers splashed out a staggering $9 billion on paintings, sculptures, and sundry installations.
But the peaceful rise has turned into a precipitous plunge. Last year, the market was barely half the size, down to a mere $5 billion. Now, that's partly due to art dealers heading for Hong Kong, but it's also having an impact on the overall size of world sales. So, are Chinese buyers losing their appetite for art? We'll soon find out with some major sales in Hong Kong over the next couple of weeks. Alexandra Herrera is the founder of Artshare and will be heading to the Sotheby's auction in Hong Kong, which I believe starts tomorrow. And in fact, Alexandra is in our studio in Hong Kong now. Welcome to the show, Alexandra.
Thank you for inviting me.
You're very welcome. Now, if you can repay us by telling us, are the Chinese actually losing their appetite for art, do you think?
No, I don't think so. And actually, I think we need to put things in context. As you rightly said, over the last 5 years, the art market in China has been the strongest growing in the world. It took over France in the third largest market in 2007, it took over the UK in 2010, and it took over the United States in 2011. So yes, after a couple of years of phenomenal growth, the art market in China began to decelerate, but it's a healthy adjustment. It's an opportunity and not really a setback. And there's still a very strong appetite. And actually what the figures that you've quoted showed is that buyers are a little bit more selective. The market is maturing. So I think there's definitely appetite, and it's a good thing for the Chinese art market here.
And Alexandra, what are people actually buying if they do buy? You know, and where has the collapse been? You know, in the past we saw that actually Chinese buyers were, there was a part of them that were only interested in bringing back, you know, traditional Chinese art or work by contemporary Chinese artists. And then there was other people who were buying up the Damien Hirst and the kind of showier pieces. Which bits of the market have fallen and which bits have kind of sustained themselves?
Well, if you look at the Chinese art market, the strong segments are still, you know, the very traditional calligraphy, and they represent the majority of the sales here. At the very opposite, we look at the young generation of artists born after the 1970s, and these are really the focus now. So what has fallen the most is the very high value. If you look at the number of lots sold above $2 million, this is definitely on the decrease. So it's again a question of selectivity. In periods of uncertainty, you see that buyers tend to go for the biggest names. So that's a trend that we're also seeing here.
Now, Alexandra, we did mention you're the founder of Artshare. Now, this is an online platform for modern and contemporary Asian art, which is about to launch this month. Now, presumably, you're going to have your eye at the Sotheby's sale on things that you'd like. What are they, and what are you going to do with them?
That's a good question. Well, there's two big auction sales upcoming now. There's the Sotheby's, as you mentioned, but also China Guardian over the weekend, which is the second largest Chinese auction house. A number of interesting artists over there that you see in every, obviously, segment of the market. I'm looking closely at some Chinese contemporary artists, such as Jia Aili, for example, which is showing at Sotheby's. We'll see. Everybody's really waiting to see what the results will be for those two sales. There's a lot of uncertainty right now, and auction do provide a very good snapshot of the current market situation. So let's wait and see what happens in the next few days.
Now, certainly not in your part of the world, but parts of this market have been kind of upset by the fact there have been quite a lot of fakes flooding onto the market. Has that been a real concern?
In China, generally, yes. Fakes and authenticity is one of the major concerns here. It depends which part of the market you're looking at. It's obviously even more relevant and important when you look at antiques and art pieces where the artist is no longer living. For contemporary, it's a little bit different. You can usually check with the artist directly or with his studios. So people are concerned about authenticity, absolutely. But it depends which part and which part of the history you're looking at.
Go ahead. You wanted to jump in.
I was going to say as well. There's this difference between the traditional sort of classical pieces that people sort of generally sort of buy up, I suppose, when they first come into wealth, and the young emerging art scene. And it's not just in mainland China itself now, which I suppose is much better established, but elsewhere in Southeast Asia, you're presumably looking at too.
Yes, that's right. I mean, in terms of our platform, we, for example, focus on Asia and not only China. And it's the case that right now there's a lot of collectors and institutions looking beyond China, obviously. And Indonesia, for example, is one of the key markets here. There are the three elements which I think really are important to sustain a strong market: great artists, important collectors, and institutions and museums.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. That was Alexandra Herrera, who's the founder of ArtShare, and he was in our Hong Kong bureau. And me and Guy were just saying how nice it is when we crossed there. You can hear the trucks and the buses whizzing past. We've got a new bureau chief there, Aisha Spears, and I don't think it was just the lorries delivering all of her luggage from New York. but you never know.
In the next half hour of the programme, we'll find out what's making the news headlines in Indonesia with our correspondent Ben Bland, and take a look at the international front pages with our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. Steve Bloomfield, that would be interesting, wouldn't it? And we'll head to Medellin to take the temperature of the entrepreneurial community.
The government's doing a great deal to support entrepreneurship. So right now, there's an organisation in Medellin called UTANE. I believe it's around a $60 million annual budget to support innovation and entrepreneurship.
But first, here's Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Guy. The US Secretary of State John Kerry has promised that America will defend itself and its allies in the face of aggression as tensions rise on the Korean Peninsula. On Tuesday, Pyongyang said it would revive a mothballed nuclear reactor capable of producing weapon-grade plutonium. In the latest development, North Korean authorities have barred South Korean workers from entering a joint industrial park on the northern side of the border. A report by two American think tanks says Iran will pursue its nuclear program, even though it's cost it well over $100 billion in lost oil revenue and foreign investment alone. The report's authors say too much pride is involved for the program to simply be abandoned. Crunch talks in Brussels aimed at ending the ethnic partition of Serbia's former Kosovo province have broken up without result. The talks have been aimed at normalizing ties 5 years after Kosovo declared independence with the backing of the West. Six New York politicians, including a senior state senator, have been arrested over an alleged bribery scandal involving the city's mayoral race. The charges center on State Senator Malcolm Smith, the Democrat from Queens, who was widely considered a long-shot candidate for City Hall. Jane Henson, the former wife of Muppets creator Jim Henson, who was influential in the creation of the popular US TV puppet program, has died at her home in Connecticut following a long battle against cancer. She was 78. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck and Guy Delaunay. It's currently 8:33 a.m. here in London, which means it's 9:33 in Berlin and 11:33 in Moscow. All this week on our weekly business show, The Entrepreneurs, we're going to be looking at the healthy transformation of a Colombian city and the business potential that's being tapped as a result.
Medellin was once the heart of the cocaine trade in Latin America and all the gang violence that went with that. But it's cleaned up its act in recent years, going from being one of the world's most dangerous cities to one of its most vibrant. Part of this turnaround is that Medellin is doing all it can to boost a new variety of entrepreneurship.
a kind that doesn't involve packets of white powder or waving a gun in a potential business partner's face. Steve Bodson, we like him here, finds out how the new projects are faring.
The main street through the center of Medellin could be anywhere in Latin America. Hawkers are selling mangoes, raspberries, baseball caps, and bootleg DVDs. That sort of entrepreneurial spirit is everywhere in the developing world. But what's surprising here in Medellin is that it's official government policy to help entrepreneurs however possible. At a neighborhood library in a hillside slum, I pick up a brochure from Cultura A, a city program to teach micro-entrepreneurs how to expand and join the formal economy. Today, such small-scale, low-tech entrepreneurship is being joined by more ambitious efforts.
My name is Connor DeGusa. I'm the co-founder of a co-working space and entrepreneurial center called Espacio, and we are in Medellin, Colombia.
Espacio occupies half a floor of an office building in the Poblado neighborhood. There are glossy white desks where young people are tapping away at MacBooks. One wall is covered in plants from the cloud forest. There's a wide view of Medellin's valley.
The entrepreneurial ecosystem, I think, compared to Silicon Valley in New York, is still very young, but certainly growing. I think one of the things we've been seeing a great deal of in Medellin is a migration of some really talented international entrepreneurs.
Agusa says Espacio has a couple of independent workers, but most of the people who use these desks are working at internet-oriented startups. There's a car-sharing company and an online financial company. People have come from far and wide.
Just looking at Espacio, for example, it's 50% foreign, 50% Colombian, and then the breakdown is, you know, we have people, whether it's from France, Germany, really all over. And I think part of the benefit is that I think Medellin's getting a lot of press recently in terms of it won the most innovative city of the year over Tel Aviv and New York.
The city also puts up money. It spent over $100 million between 2004 and 2011 on entrepreneurship programs, helping to create over 11,000 businesses with more than 20,000 jobs. It has also funded the creation of an angel investor network and is now helping to create a venture capital fund.
The government's doing a great deal to support entrepreneurship. So right now, there's an organization in Medellin called UTAENE, and I believe they have, it's around a $60 million annual budget to support innovation and entrepreneurship. So as an example of what they're doing, they're helping fund the first early stage venture capital firm. It's going to be between a $10 to $15 million fund.
Meanwhile, the city has gotten safer. This used to be the site of constant battles between drug cartels. There were car bombs and constant reports of murders. Today, the city is safe for visitors, and there's a boom in outdoor cafes. Joana Molina grew up here. She's now country manager for the Intern Group, which seeks to connect interns to companies in Latin America.
When I was a child, there was basically not many foreigners. It was very insecure. It was a lot of violence and what people really knows. But more and more, now that you see international investors, universities coming from abroad to see here and to send the students here, really the city has been, right now is another city. If you compare Medellin 2013 to like the 90s, it will be completely different. And that's why we are very proud of, because we don't deny what the history of our city is, but we really don't want to go into that again.
Aside from promoting entrepreneurship, the local government has also put a priority on livability.
That's part of like some policy that the government wants to do, and is that more and more increasing those outdoor spaces for pedestrians, like closing streets only for pedestrians. And well, I mean, when you have such a great weather, this is called the city of eternal spring, so why not having a cafe, restaurant, anything outdoor?
Agusa himself is one of the people who is trapped by Medellin's pro-startup environment. He came for a three-month visit to learn Spanish, but ended up starting his own business and is now planning to stay. For Monocle, in Medellin, I'm Stephen Bodson.
And we'll have more business reports from around the globe, including what makes the perfect CEO, and a chat with Garrett Camp. That's a real name, apparently. He's the man behind a ride-sharing service for private jets on tonight's edition of The Entrepreneurs with Sophie Grove. That's at 1900 London time.
You're listening to Midori House. We'll be right back after this with tales from Jakarta of tycoons-turned-politicians, military shenanigans, and Indonesia's ever-swelling fuel subsidies.
Taiwan's southern port of Kaohsiung is the topic of our latest Monocle film. Once a neglected sibling to Taipei, we visit a city attempting to balance industry with livability.
Kaohsiung is most intriguing in that it's no post-industrial town searching for a new reason to be. Rather than move beyond its industrial roots, Kaohsiung is aiming to show that it can sculpt a city that people want to live in without sacrificing its role as the industrial heart of Taiwan.
Taiwan. Turning the Tide on Monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House. The time here is 8:40 in London, and it's 14:40 in Jakarta, and that's where we're heading now. Ben Bland, our man in Indonesia, joins us with a fistful of stories from Indonesia.
Welcome to the show, Ben. I think you're going to start with a story of a tycoon who would rather like to be president of Indonesia.
Yes, indeed. Abu Rizal Bakri is the patriarch of one of Indonesia's wealthiest families. He's certainly not the first tycoon around the world to have his eye on political power, but he's definitely one of the most prominent in Indonesia. His family have a long history in business world. They built up a big empire from property to coal mines to TV stations and even football clubs in Belgium and Australia. And Abu Rizal Bakri, who's now stepped away officially, at least from the business, to focus on politics, is something of a Silvio Berlusconi-type figure for Indonesia, although we must say minus the sex scandals and court cases.
It has to be said, though, when I talk to Indonesians about business people, the opinions you get back aren't generally flattering. Is Mr. Bakri any different in the popular concern, do you think?
Well, his political party, the Golkar Party of former dictator General Suharto, is the second most popular party at the moment in Indonesia, and it's a very strong party with good connections all across Indonesia, which gives him a good platform on a party basis. Personally, he doesn't do too well in the polling, and that's for a number of reasons, not least because one of the family's companies is connected in many people's eyes with a massive mud volcano that exploded in 2006 after oil drilling by one of the family's associated companies. But the family and Mr. Bakri himself have always denied any wrongdoing. And when I met him recently, he even claimed that actually life for the people in the six or seven villages who've seen their homes engulfed by boiling mud is actually better since the disaster, because they've been able to benefit from financial aid he's given them, despite the fact that the family insists, you know, they've been cleared of any wrongdoing. So he's certainly controversial, but he argues his business experience actually gives him a strong basis on which to transform Indonesia's economy, to push it up from GDP growth levels of around 6% to 8%, and to tackle some of the intractable justice and other issues that have been hanging around in Indonesia. And he says Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono, the current president, hasn't been strong enough. But as a tycoon who knows how to do deals and to get things done, he'd be a much stronger leader for Indonesia. But I think we'll have to see if the voters agree. But either way, he's very influential because of his political party. So he's going to be involved in the mix, whether as a leading candidate for the presidency or as some sort of kingmaker.
And just before we move on from this story, can I ask you, often people give interviews at this time, and he's certainly given an interview this week to Western media. They do this because they're not doing so well in the ratings. Where is he currently standing at the moment?
Well, there are a number of different survey agencies here, and they tend to vary wildly. I mean, this is a country of 240 million people spread on thousands of different islands, so it's very hard to get accurate polling. But at the moment, in different polls, he's coming in around second or third, with around between 10 and 15% which isn't bad, as it puts him in the top two or three. But so far, most of the candidates who've emerged are less than inspiring. They're mostly business people, generals, former political figures from Indonesia's past. And there's a definite shortage of new candidates who are going to energize the electorate. So if any such figures were to emerge, I think it could definitely change the game. If it's just going to be a battle between a number of sort of pre-existing political and business figures, then he probably has as good a chance as any.
Now, Ben, we mentioned before you'd be talking about military shenanigans, but perhaps shenanigans is not quite the word for a group of highly trained masked men breaking into a prison in central Java, disabling the guards and executing gangsters who were accused of killing a member of the special forces.
Yeah, it's quite an incredible story, really. I was actually in the city where this happened, Yogyakarta, at the time. We were just on holiday. And it's at heart, the issue is the role of the military in society. I mean, when General Suharto was ousted from power in 1998, his sort of military-driven dictatorship sort of was dismantled. The military mostly went back to the barracks. They retreated, for the most part, from political life and economic life, where they played a big role. But now you have this huge army all around Indonesia with really not much to do, because the police have taken over all the civil security functions. In this particular case, there was a member of the special forces who was murdered in a bar in Yogyakarta, we think, by these four gangsters, who were later arrested and put in this police-run prison. And in the middle of the night, this group of masked gunmen broke in. They went to the trouble of disabling the CCTV. They took cell phones off all the guards and tied them up, and they executed at point blank range these four people who were suspected of killing a special forces member. Now the rumors and the popular suspicion, of course, is that the special forces were behind this attack. The president has called for an investigation, which is ongoing, and we don't know what's going to transpire. But this certainly isn't the first example of the military getting involved in clashes either with gangsters or with the police, who in some ways are still their rivals within Indonesia for power. So earlier this year, there was a police station in South Sumatra that was burnt down by a group of soldiers following a local dispute between the police and the army. So there's still definitely an unresolved tension at the heart of Indonesian society about what to do with these armed forces, given they've lost their previous role.
And Ben, I'm sure that there's many other regional governments that are concerned as well, because I guess if you're sitting in Burma, you're worrying, you know, what will happen there with the move of the army out of political life. But do you think that actually in Indonesia, you alluded there to at the beginning of this section, that it's a country of thousands of islands with very disparate kind of groups of people. Is it very hard to have any centralized control over something like the army for the government?
Actually, the army is one of the more centralized institutions. Indonesia as a whole, as part of the democratization process after the fall of Suharto, went through one of the biggest phases of decentralization that any country on earth has ever seen. So there are lots of disputes between local governments and the central government, between different regions where there's overlapping jurisdictions, particularly as it pertains to natural resources and business and money. The army actually has quite good centralized command structures, but then invariably in such a big country, when local disputes arise, the people easily resort to violence, whether it's ordinary people, whether it's soldiers, or whether it's the police. There's a general sense that the justice system is not very fair. There are a lot of cases of corruption involving the judiciary. And so whether it's the police just having a dispute with the army, whether it's neighbors having a dispute over their fence or different villages in dispute over a failed marriage, people tend to quickly resort to violence, which is a concern for all Indonesians and for people investing. I mean, the country's largely been on a very peaceful transition from dictatorship and authoritarian rule to democracy. But there are definitely concerns that not enough is being done to ensure justice, and that therefore this sort of violent tendency still bubbles along under the surface.
Well, Ben, thanks very much for joining us today on Indonesia's young developing democracy. Thanks for joining us from Jakarta.
Now, in a moment, we're going to be looking at the international front pages with our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. But first, some music. This is Dengue Fever with Cannibal Courtship.
How good was that, eh? How good was that?
Well, it is good, although, let's be honest, we do have a little bit of script here occasionally to go by, and you had written into my part of the script, yeah, good choice. And that's because you can't say the name of this band, can you, Guy, without saying they're my best friends?
They are close personal friends of mine. Okay.
Well, I guess if you've been living out in Cambodia, there's not many kind of rock stars to hang out with.
There aren't many Cambodian rock and roll bands, so we are. But I found them.
But you got in there. And just before we move on, we very much enjoy going to Hong Kong and hearing the kind of the hum of Hong Kong. We went to Jakarta. We heard a squeaky door. I'm going to send some olive oil over to Ben so he can oil the door in the background of his poor old bureau. But anyway, we're going to be moving on now, aren't we, Guy?
Indeed we are. You're listening to Midori House with me, Guy Delaunay, and Andrew Tuck. And it's time now to look at the international front pages with our foreign editor, Steve... You see, I nearly did it again, didn't
he called
I?
You Steve Bloomfield earlier
on. Did he?
On. Yes.
Really?
Listen, Steve Bloomfield, I think...
Can I just say, that's not the first time anyone said that on this radio station. A number of people have called me Steam Bloomfield.
It's going to have to be a trademark, Steve.
Yes, we'll go with the T-shirt made.
But maybe you've had your head over a bowl of steam.
Because you've got a bit of a cold.
I'm feeling all right, don't worry,
good.
Don't worry.
He's perking
I'm wrapped
He's
perking up warm. So you've had squeaking doors, you've had rustling things. I've got a rustle of newspapers
yes,
here.
That's a nice sound effect.
Indeed. So we're going to talk about Turkey, we're going to talk about a chess champion. But first, I must mention that the story that's on the front pages of all the UK papers today. It's this horrific story of Mick Philpott and his wife, Mairead, and a friend of theirs, Paul Mosley, who were found guilty yesterday. Of killing their six children in a, as the Guardian says here, in twisted plot that went wrong. Evil, stupid and shameful is the headline. Those were the words of the judge. They had tried to burn down the family home and then save the children in an attempt to try and pin this on Mick Philpott's girlfriend or former girlfriend. And it went horribly wrong. The six children died. This story has obviously sort of captured the imagination of pretty much everyone in the country. And it's on the front pages of every single newspaper.
And the interesting thing I think in the UK is this story and this family have been used to kind of try and prove all sorts of points. So the tabloid press are leading with the fact that he was on benefits and he took drugs, and you know they're saying he's a prime example. I think the Daily Mail today leads with the story. He's the prime example of what's wrong with welfare Britain. Whereas the Independent have gone with a different line, saying that he proves nothing about anything to Britain. He's just an evil man.
But this is that these events are so exceptional that you can't actually draw anything from them at all. It's a complete outlier. This is a man with 17 children that he had in total.
I mean, if he was a banker, we wouldn't be saying, oh, well, you know, this just proves that bankers are evil. It's it's one horrible story about really sort of, yeah, a very powerful man who... you know, who's killed six of his children.
It's very hard to bear when one has children oneself. And I'm sorry if this is a bit of a cliche, but it does change everything. And the horror that you feel when you hear about stories like that is completely visceral.
So that story is on the front pages pretty much everywhere in the UK. Some other stories inside the papers. Wall Street Journal Europe has an interesting story on Turkey moves to strengthen its ties with Europe. This comes after last week. We've seen sort of in recent weeks Europe and Turkey have begun to sort of edge a little bit closer to each other. And I think two things have happened here. One is that Nicolas Sarkozy is no longer president of France. He had a kind of really odd animosity towards Turkey, which a lot of Turks didn't really understand. François Hollande has been much more open to the idea of Turkey becoming members of the EU. And at the same time, Turkey has found its economy shrinking, and also with everything else that's happening within its region, it's seen the need for more ties with the European Union. Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan is going to visit Brussels soon. It'll be the first time in 3 years. The Deputy Prime Minister Ali Babacan has today said, don't worry, we're going to stay within the customs union, which was negotiated back in 1996. There have been some calls for them to pull out. So it's just interesting. They're sort of edging towards each other a bit more than they had before.
I think possibly some regrets on the part of Brussels that the standard of members they ended up with in their expansion, and they didn't get Turkey, which has been the star.
Well, indeed, yes. I think if they could go back and say, you know, do we we want Cyprus or do we want Turkey? I think they probably want Turkey. And the fact is, you know, both I think need each other. You know, a strong European Union needs Turkey, and Turkey, despite the fact that it sort of has looked a lot to the east, could really do with being in the European Union.
Now, you've met quite a few people high up in Ankara over the last few years. Have you noticed a kind of a changing wind of opinion back and forth between whether the EU tie-up is a good or a bad thing?
Yes, and I think, you know, when we first started going to Ankara and talking to people there, it was interesting. Yes, it was maybe 3 years ago. The attitude there was like, well, fine. If Europe doesn't need us, we don't need you. We'll be completely fine in our neighbourhood. But yes, I mean, I think, you know, they would far prefer to be within the European Union. I mean, you know, the thing with Turkey to remember is that Turkey considers itself part of the West. Even if the West has always been a little bit, oh, really, are they? You know, it's the second largest standing army in NATO. It's, you know, it was, you know, on the West side during the Cold War. So it wasn't until 1997 when the EU announced its 10 accession states and Turkey wasn't on the list that it suddenly realised, oh, hang on, the West doesn't see us in exactly the same way. We got time for one more?
Yes, quickly.
Okay. Again, someone who's featured in Monocle a lot before, Magnus Carlsen, 22-year-old Norwegian chess champion.
We had him as a national icon.
We did 2 years ago. Really, really lovely guy. He has just won a tournament here in London called the Candidates Tournament, which means that he will get to play the world champion later this year to see whether he becomes, despite the fact he is number one chess champion, see if he becomes world champion. And he's the sort of person that really can transform that game. He's he's good looking. He's got sponsorship deals with clothes companies. He's a nice young man.
He's the Tiger Woods of chess.
He really is, but without the, you know, the scandals.
The former Tiger Woods, the original Tiger Woods.
Exactly. So there we are, Magnus Carlsen. Remember him.
Nice move, Steve. We like that move. That was Steve Bloomfield, who's our foreign editor, and that's concluding our newspaper roundup, and in fact, concluding the show for today, because that's all we have time for. So thank you to our producer, Ala John, our researchers, Alexander de Kramer and Annabelle Bly, and our studio manager, Alex Funnell. Up next, after the news, Marcus Hippie will bring you the latest edition of The Menu. Hugo MacDonald and Sophie Grove will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But from me, Andrew Tuck,
and me, Guy Delaunay,
it's time to say goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.
It's 1700 hours in Tokyo, 10 a.m. in Vienna, 9 a.m. at Midori House in London, 4 a.m. in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Monocle 24. Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. China's foreign ministry says a senior official has met ambassadors from the United States and both Koreas to express serious concern about the situation on the Korean Peninsula. In the latest development, North Korean authorities have barred South Korean workers from entering a joint industrial park on the northern side of the border. It's not immediately clear if the move's aimed at closing the Kaesong industrial zone, which generates $2 billion a year in trade for the North and $80 million in cash.